Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half here on Premier Christian Radio. This is Unbelievable, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. I hope you enjoy the next hour and a half in my company, and I look forward to telling you what's coming up in just a moment. Don't forget, though, that later on this afternoon, after this programme, our youth music programme, Hip Rock UK, coming up, and lots more besides this Saturday afternoon, the 18th of December. Not long now till Christmas, and I've got special news as well of a special Christmas Day edition of Unbelievable this time next week. Let's find out what's going on today's programme. You're unbelievable. And it's my great pleasure to welcome back to the studio today Adnan Rashid, who is part of the Hitton Institute. He's a Muslim speaker and apologist. And today he's in conversation with a guest who's coming on by phone from Australia. Yes, we're an international programme today. Mark Dury is an Australian church leader and author of a book called The Third Choice, Islam, Dimitude and Freedom. And in that book, he makes the case that the doctrine of dimitude in Islam is an unjust, oppressive and discriminatory code against those of other faiths. We're going to be finding out what exactly it is and whether it continues today. Mark makes the claim that Muslims are seeking to bring it in various ways to Western civilization. But we're going to be sort of hearing his story and his area of research in this. Mark, thank you for joining me on the programme today.
It's great to be with you.
It's good to have you on. Islam, Dimitude and Freedom is the subtitle of your book, The Third Choice. Many people may not have heard of dimitude. Could you, in a nutshell, explain what dimitude is?
Yes, Muhammad told his followers when they met non-Muslims to offer them three choices. One was to fight the sword. Another was to convert to Islam and become Muslims, and the fighting would then cease. And the third was to surrender and live under Islamic rule. And this surrender makes the non-Muslims into a particular category of people under the Islamic justice or jurisprudence, and they're known as dhimmis. The name comes from the pact that's understood in Islamic law to be their pact of surrender, which is the dhimma pact. A dhimmi is then someone who's not a Muslim living in Islamic society, and they were understood to owe their lives to Muslims, so that is, they were allowed to live and keep their religion on condition of occupying an inferior place within Islamic jurisprudence. And this is the classical view of Islamic law, and there had been some relaxation of some of the principles of Islamic law in treatment of non-Muslims, but many aspects of the law still apply in Muslim countries, and there's been a trend to bring them back. And so non-Muslims, Christians are the largest group at the moment living under Islamic rule, but other groups as well are coming under increasing pressure from this system. And dimitude is a word to describe the psychology, the whole worldview of being a dhimmi, being someone living as a conquered person in your own native lands with the conceded but not inherent rights conceded to you by the Muslims who've at some point in the past conquered your lands.
Well, I look forward to hearing sort of as we get into the discussion more about what that constitutes and what some of the issues are that it raises. What drew you to actually write on this, Mark? Is there a significant sort of issue here in Australia surrounding this? Have you seen examples in Australia where you would say dimitude, or those who would wish to bring back aspects of dimitude,
is alive and well?
In a somewhat mild way. I remember there was a case where a local council had given some land for a multi-religious group of buildings, and the Catholics were building a building, and Muslims had a building, and Muslims created a lot of objections to the Catholic plans because the building was taller than theirs, and also they had a cross on the top, which the Muslims were offended by, and that's a classic Vimy law that non-Muslims are not allowed to display signal symbols, particularly the cross, in public. So that's an example of a local planning issue that was really in some deep way to do with Islamic law. But my interest in Islam really was first stirred by living in Aceh in Indonesia doing field work towards a PhD back in the late 70s, early 80s. And at that time I was interested in Islam itself. And my book is sort of half about Islam and half about what it means to live under Islamic law. But I've met so many Christians from the Middle East and from Pakistan and countries that have lived under Islamic conditions, and that's had sort of weighed heavily upon me to hear their stories and realize the often very difficult situation and circumstances that they find themselves in those countries.
Many of the Muslims I engage on this program, and last week we heard Adnan talking about it, believe that Islam properly run, as it were, properly instituted, is a system whereby people can exist happily together, and that there has been a golden age, if you like, of Islam that needs to be in some sense brought back. In your experience, Dhimmitude, does it live up to that in any sense, or do you radically differ from what Adnan will be talking about today?
I differ completely. I think both the evidence of the Islamic textbooks, that is what the great scholars say the system should look like, and also the historical sources in terms of what the actual lived conditions were of non-Muslims under Islam, and the evidence today, all point to the direction that it's pretty grim to be a non-Muslim living in a Sharia society. You're discriminated against. Your testimony is not valid against the Muslims in court, so you are very vulnerable at law. Women are particularly vulnerable. If you break any of the conditions of the Dhimma system, whether it's witnessing to your faith or displaying publicly a symbol of your faith or not paying the discriminatory taxes that were imposed, then you could make yourself and your community liable for retribution. And the evidence is that these have the conditions have been pretty grim. Some periods worse than others, but never really a utopia. People sometimes speak of the golden age of Andalusia, for example. But the evidence of Muslim historians was that in the 8th century in Spain or Andalusia at the time, Christians and Jews had to wear discriminatory patches on their clothes. Jews wore patches in the shape of an ape and Christians of a pig to show that they were different, and at that time there were harems in place that were full of Christian captives that had been taken in warfare against the Christian surrounding nations. So this is not really equality or freedom. Sharia law mandates inequality and inferiority for non-Muslims.
Finally, how, in what sense, has Dhimmitude, as it were, disappeared, or has it disappeared and is beginning to reappear, which is partly where I think your book is coming from?
Yeah, it never really disappeared. I mean, one of the worst aspects of it, the payment of the jizya, discriminatory jizya tax, was largely not in place in the Muslim world, although there are local areas where some Muslims are trying to bring it back.
Just explain that a little bit. The jizya tax is something that, under the doctrine of Dhimmitude, non-Muslims had to pay essentially a tax above and beyond what the normal citizens would be expected to pay to carry on being a non-Muslim.
Yeah, historical sources suggest it's several times more than the tax that Muslims paid. It's described by Islamic legal textbooks as a redemption for their blood or their life. That is, they would buy their life back for a year. I'm quoting literally from Islamic commentaries. So the idea was that being conquered, your conqueror could have killed you, but by letting you live, you owe them a debt, and you buy your life back. It's like a city that pays tribute in order not to be attacked. Again, this is described in detail in many commentaries, and so it was a redemption tax, this is sort of largely it's not applying now in Muslim countries, although there are radical groups that want it back. But many of the laws of dhimmitude do apply, and they have been coming back with a vengeance. So, for example, in Egypt today, you can't build a church without presidential approval or repair a church without a governor's approval. And the reason for that is that in Sharia law, dhimmis are not supposed to repair or build places of worship. So this ancient code from the 7th century is controlling and influencing restrictions on worship of Christians in Egypt. And they're incredibly frustrated that Muslims can repair a mosque or build a mosque very easily, but if they want to repair the toilets in the church, they risk a riot if they don't have the approval of the governor. And this is very demeaning and humiliating, and there have been some very significant riots and even people killed by security forces in Egypt recently over this very issue of refusal of permits of churches.
Well, thank you for sort of outlining the general area, and now comes the discussion between yourself and Adnan. Adnan Rashid is with me, and Adnan is a Muslim, regularly contributes to this program, and is part of the Hittin Institute. Adnan, I think it's important to distinguish what applies as a dhimmi. I, in your eyes, am not a dhimmi because we're not living under an Islamic state here in the UK. I am just simply someone of another faith, and we coexist. A dhimmi, presumably, is someone who, under an Islamic state, holds to a different religion. But do you agree with Marx's characterization of dhimmitude historically and where he sees it in contemporary situations?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdulillah wa ba'd. Thank you very much, Mark, for your treatment of this subject in your book, firstly, and secondly, in this debate or in this friendly dialogue we're having now. I don't agree with Marx's characterization of the concept of Ahl-Dhimma or Dhimma in Islam. Marx has picked up this term, dhimmitude, from Bat Yor, and I can see a foreword was done by her. She is a Zionist lady who was born in Egypt, and she has clearly demonstrated in her books that she doesn't like Islam. By default, Islam is just not something she will accept. So her works seem to be very biased, and even if you look at some of the academic works in this regard today, you hardly see anyone quoting her in footnotes or in references, even though she has collected a lot of literature in her books. I mean, she's done quite few books, like 3 or 4 books on this topic. So I feel Marx has taken his concept of dhimma from a very biased source, which is Bat Yor, because Marx simply picked up the term dhimmitude from her. She is the one who coined the term. The concept of dhimma is not very complicated in Islam. It simply it simply means in Arabic, dhimma, the ones you take responsibility for. Ahl-Dhimma are the ones you take responsibility for, and you are responsible for their protection. So these are the people who will pay you a small amount of tax in return for protection given by the state, because they are different. They are not Muslims. Now, there is a perception among some of the authors, such as Mark Durie, that this tax was very high, and people were paying these amounts under severe pressure, which doesn't seem to be the case historically, and I will substantiate that through quoting some of the sources I have in front of me, some of the academic sources, unlike Bat Yor. We find out when we study the historical works, such as Kitab al-Khiraj, written by Qadi Abu Yusuf in the 2nd century of Islam, who collected these sources from the Islamic literature to... basically, the book is written about taxes in Islam. And the book Kitab al-Khiraj, the book of taxes, what it is called, states clearly that you charge 1 dinar per head from a rich non-Muslim, and someone who's a middle-class non-Muslim, you charge them 24 dirhams, 24 silver coins, and someone who is like not very well off, you charge them 12 dirhams. So the highest amount of tax a non-Muslim would be paying in an Islamic state would be equivalent to one gold coin, one dinar. And that's equivalent to almost £50 today, or maximum £80 today, depending on how much 4 gram of gold would be worth today.
But regardless of what the amount might be, and Mark may differ from you, what it sounds like in some sense is like a protection racket, you know, like the mafia would have, you know, pay us and we won't basically come and beat your doors down of your restaurant. I mean, essentially, you call it looking after them, but is it not, as Mark has described, essentially paying money so that they're not killed by their Muslim conquerors?
That's an interesting comparison with mafia and how the government would react, or how the government would act if the tax wasn't paid. But if you study the history of Islam carefully, you'll come to realize that those Muslims who refused to pay the tax, which is zakat, which is compulsory charity, if you refuse to pay that tax, you are also treated as the non-Muslims would be treated if they refuse to pay their tax. So even the Muslims are paying tax under a different name. So zakat is 2.5% of every single Muslim's savings, while in the case of the non-Muslims, you only pay a limited set amount, which is one dinar. Whether you're a millionaire or a pauper, it doesn't really matter. You pay one set amount. But with the Muslims, they very often end up paying high amounts, much higher than what the non-Muslims are paying, historically.
Just coming back to the title of Mark's book, which is The Third Choice, he calls it that because the option of becoming a dhimmi was the third choice. When a country was conquered by Islam, the individual could either convert to Islam, be executed, or become a dhimmi, pay the tax, and live under these certain codes and rules, etc. Do you agree with that fundamental kind of description of what the choices were to a person who, when an Islamic state was established?
Well, Mark is right when he says that there were three choices given. This was done in the 7th century, in the beginning stages of the Islamic expansion, as we know it in history. But after the Muslims had conquered these lands, there was no third choice. There were non-Muslims who were living with the Muslims, and they were born of Christian and Jewish and Zoroastrian families, and they were living as non-Muslims under Muslim ruler. They were not given three choices. They were not given a choice of convert or fight or pay jizya. They were simply born as al-dhimma, the people who were protected people, and they lived as that until they died. And this pattern continued until the Ottomans were governing till 1924. So I don't think Mark has put it quite accurately.
All right,
if that's what he means.
You're listening to, just before we come back to Mark for his response, a program looking at the issue of dhimmitude. If you're not familiar with that term, it's essentially a doctrine in Islam about how those under Islam who are not non-Muslims should be treated. And in his book, The Third Choice, Mark Dury makes the case that it is an oppressive and discriminatory code. On the other hand, Adnan Rashid, my Muslim guest today, says it is a just rule of Islam, and it provides for the protection of people who are not Muslims in certain situations. Does it continue today? Are Muslims seeking to bring it back in some sense to places where it has not been around for a while? Well, that is the contention of Mark in his book. So we're going to continue today. And if you'd like to respond to anything you hear on the show today, I do encourage you to get in touch. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget, this programme available right now as a podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Coming back to you, Mark, what's your response then to Adnan? He says, ultimately, you've mischaracterised dhimmitude. It wasn't nearly as expensive, if you like, to pay this jizya tax as you make out. And, you know, the idea that they were somehow oppressed is simply overstating the case. And even to suggest that these were the only three options available, convert, be killed, or become a dhimmi, is also a misrepresentation. What's your response?
I'm very confident in the accuracy of what I've described. I looked at more than 80 commentaries on the Quran and many other Islamic sources, most of the sources in my book, in fact, Islamic authorities. Let me quote Abu Yusuf, who was referred to for his work on the revenues of the Islamic State. He said that the jizya, as part of the fey, which is part of the income that comes to the state, comes to the Muslims, or is restored to Muslims by non-Muslims who've made peace on the condition of paying the jizya, this poll tax, to save themselves from slaughter. So it's very clear in his description that that's the purpose of the payment of the tax. I disagree with Adnan's description of the dhimma as meaning responsibility. In fact, the Arabic word dhamma, from which the word is derived, means to find fault with or censure, and I think it's more accurately described as a pact of liability or of blame, and there is a liability, really, for your life. As for what the actual taxes are, there's quite a lot of documentary evidence on this. Arthur Triton, looking at papyri records from the 8th century in Egypt, found that on average the jizya payments were around 3 or 4 months' wages for a day labourer. So about 30% or so of your annual wage was being paid in jizya at the time. And there's lots of evidence of people from the 8th right through the Middle Ages in Egypt having to flee because they couldn't pay the taxes, or selling their children to slavery in order to pay the taxes. But Goitain, in his study of Geniza documents from Cairo, said that people would just take to wandering as beggars because they'd run out of money or they'd go into hiding. People, a lot of laments about the unbearable burden of the taxation. So I think that there's quite a lot of misrepresentation here. And Islamic sources as well speak about the heaviness of the burden. One of the problems about this system is that it's really very oppressive and an unpleasant subject, but there's a lot of propaganda, really, and a kind of a polishing up of history to make it sound good. I do take very strong exception to the claim that my book is just based on, as I said, I was very careful to rely primarily on the sources of Islamic jurists and Islamic authorities, as well as contemporary documentary evidence.
When you talk about the fact that there's a certain embellishment or tidying up in terms of the propaganda, as you call it, of surrounding these types of doctrine, I mean, you don't pull your punches in the book. You effectively suggest near the start of the third choice that Muslims are, if you like, given permission in the Quran to lie for the sake of the spread of Islam. And is this something you would say is occurring when it comes to the justifications for dhimma and for the types of things that you see as happening today in certain Islamic context?
I think that's a very complex question. Under certain circumstances, deception is permissible or even obligatory in Islam. The classic case is really when Muslims feel threatened or under pressure, under danger, and they depend upon non-Muslims for their safety. Some might also regard it as part of warfare, of jihad or conflict. I think some Muslim scholars do deceive about the issue of the Dhimma Pact. Others are deceived by their view of the perfection of Islam. That is, it's a doctrine of faith that Islam must have been perfect. And so they read the evidence in a very biased way. They pull out the bits that seem to fit with that prejudice and ignore the evidence to the contrary.
Let's allow Adnan to come in here, because Adnan, on last week's program, you were describing, as I say, what you saw as a golden age of Islam, which presumably is what Mark is referencing here, that there has been, if you like, some epoch in Islamic history where things were done correctly and there was this peace and the harmony that Islam brought, even with people who were non-Muslims. Mark says okay, he struggles to find this supposed golden age. What is your proof for the Islam does work, and the doctrine of dimitude can be implemented in a just way?
Right, I'll look into that once we study some of the evidence in front of me. It's quite interesting that Mark has actually accused some of the scholars of deliberately deceiving the masses into believing that dhimmitude, as he puts it, is something attractive. Well, Mark, let me inform you on this point that I've been studying Islam for almost 10 years, and I haven't come across any Muslim scholar who believes in deliberately lying to spread his religion. It's absolutely forbidden. It's absolutely haram in Islam to lie to spread this religion, to propagate the religion of Islam. However, it is allowed in Islam to save your life by lying. If there is a sword on your head and you are about to be killed, then in that case you're allowed to blaspheme, not lie. Sorry, I mean, let me rephrase my sentence here again. You're not allowed to lie, but you're allowed to utter blasphemy in order to save your life. If someone is asking you to commit blasphemy to save your life, you are allowed to do that. And it's very clear in the Quran, but nowhere in the Quran it states that you are allowed to lie to propagate your religion. No, we're not allowed to lie about our religion once we are talking about it. Now, coming to the issue of the money, the tax, and as Mark has disputed my claim.
Could we come to that in just a moment, because we're just running out of time on this section, and sure. we will hear your response there, Adnan Rashid, my Muslim guest today on the programme. In conversation with Mark Dury, who's on the line from Australia, he's a church leader and author of The Third Choice, Islam, Dimitude and Freedom. We're finding out what dimitude is and the different interpretations that Mark and Adnan have about it, and how it has historically treated, how it maybe currently treats non-Muslims under that doctrine. So do join us again for the next part of the programme, Unbelievable, the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together, with me, your host, Justin Brierley, here on Premier Christian Radio.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley. We're talking about Islam and Christianity today, particularly looking, though, at Islam and the way under Islamic law non-Muslims are treated. And Mark Dury has written a book on this. He's an Australian church leader, author of The Third Choice. And this book talks about the concept of dimitude. And Mark says that it is a system of law that specifically oppresses and discriminates against non-Muslims. It has existed historically and it continues to exist in various forms. Adnan Rashid is my Muslim guest on the programme today. He disputes that this is the correct way of understanding dimitude. But we did kind of just have Adnan there refuting this idea that Islam allows lying in order to advance the religion. He says the only instance he could come across of that is that when someone's life is at stake, there is a permission given to blaspheme in order to save the life of a Muslim. Mark, you obviously read it very differently to that.
Yeah, I think that is in the Quran, that principle, but Islam is also based on the life of Muhammad, and there are a number of instances which jurists have used to justify the use of deception. For example, in warfare, Muhammad licensed that in fighting others, and sometimes in resolving disputes. There are a number of circumstances, and philosophers like Al-Ghazali, one of the great Muslim writers, did develop a sort of general theology of lying, which allowed it to be used. If the goal was a good goal, then the means could be put to that end. But I think the actual effect of this is very complex, and I think a lot of it is wishful thinking, but it's very selective reading of the sources. So people overlook what they don't want to hear, and they present the best of it, really, and ignore the evidence to the contrary. So a lot of it is more kind of it's the spin problem rather than the direct deception, although that sometimes is an issue as well.
I mean, I don't want us to get too derailed by this issue, because it's not kind of central to what we're talking about today, but obviously let's agree that you have a different understanding of where this is coming from.
Absolutely. Yes, I know what Mark is referring to. Mark is referring to a tradition from the Prophet that war is deception. And this is what the scholars have been commenting on. Yes, war is deception. That's what war is. In war, you deceive, you lie, and you try to cheat your enemy because you're trying to defeat your enemy. So war is a human phenomenon, and all human beings have dealt with war in similar way. So this is about war, but we're talking about dhimmitude here. A suggestion was made that Muslims are allowed to deceive in order to advance their religion. Perhaps I misunderstood it, but it is utterly forbidden in Islam to advance our religion by lying. Coming back to the issue of taxes, the issue of how much the non-Muslims have to pay. I have a historical source right here in front of me, and I would like to speak with substance, as Mark would like me to do. There is a treaty which took place in Islamic Spain in the year 713, in the year 713 CE. This treaty is quoted by Olivia Constable in her book Medieval Iberia. The treaty states, in the name of Allah, the Merciful, the Compassionate, this is a document granted by Abdulaziz bin Musa bin Nusayr to Theodomir, son of Gabdush, establishing a treaty of peace and a promise and protection of God and his Prophet. We Muslims will not set special conditions for him or for any among his men, nor harass him, nor remove him from power. His followers will not be killed or taken prisoner, nor will they be separated from their women and children. They will not be coerced in matters of religion. Their churches will not be burnt, nor will sacred objects be taken from them. As long as he remains, Theodomir remains sincere and fulfills the conditions we have set for him, he has reached a settlement concerning seven towns. He will not give shelter to fugitives, nor to our enemies, nor encourage any protected persons to fear us, nor conceal news of our enemies. He and each of his men shall also pay one dinar every year. One dinar every year. So this is one dinar per head every year. So this is clear-cut evidence in front of us from the 8th century, 713 CE, from Spain, where Muslims are demanding one dinar from the Christians in order to receive that protection. And the protection
and it's a sort of peace treaty, really.
It's a peace treaty. This is what the Dhimma contract is. This is exactly what Dhimma contract, the responsibility, the protection contract, stands for. Now, there are other similar treaties. The Treaty of Jerusalem, the Treaty of Najran is similar. The Treaty of Medina is very similar. So these are the terms which were granted, which were given, offered to the Christians. How did the Christians react now? The question is, Mark seems to be presenting a picture which is very, very hostile, very, very ugly.
I
reject the accusation of hostility. I'm trying to be objective and clear, and referencing Islamic sources and also contemporary historical sources. Because it portrays Islam in a negative, that doesn't mean I'm hostile. It just means I'm trying to be accurate. Attributing someone with wrong motives is no answer to the argument that they put.
Okay. I appreciate that. I misunderstood what Mark is trying to say.
The point remains that as far as you look at the evidence, Adnan, these pacts, these treaties that were drawn up, these dhimmitude pacts, were essentially peace treaties, and they were not aimed at subjugating another.
And if we look at the evidence from the Christians and the Jews, let's see what they had to say themselves. If we go to the Christian sources, what the Christians were writing themselves, we come to realize that they were living in peace and they actually enjoyed their lives under Muslim rule. For example, in the year 869 CE, Patriarch Theodosius of Jerusalem wrote to his friend in Constantinople, the Patriarch of Constantinople. He wrote, "The Saracens, i.e. the Muslims, show us great goodwill. They allow us to build our churches and to observe our own customs without hindrance."
That's great. I mean, you've certainly outlined there are multiple examples in your view that would contradict Mark's analysis. Mark, what is it, just that you've got a different set of examples and you can show that there are instances in which it was a lot more hostile situation for non-Muslims?
There are many, many cases, a lot of evidence that it wasn't this kind of idealized situation. Often the lived reality was worse than what the legal textbook said. And you get voices, for example, a Jewish merchant from medieval Sicily under Islamic rule saying that the Dhimmis were preferred death to life. Most of them, he said, are poor and destitute. Many fled. It's James Riley, who is a ship's captain from a U.S. shipwrecked in Morocco and enslaved, describes how if Jews were too poor to pay the jizya, they were just beaten until they converted to Islam. This kind of idealized picture of history, which assumes, sort of portrays a perfect, unchanging, utopian kind of conception and is very happy to pick out a phrase here or a phrase there to justify it and ignores overwhelming evidence the other way, is really unhelpful and is part, I think, of the misleading of people of the historical reality. And the problems that groups like the Copts in Egypt today or Christians in Pakistan are facing are very serious human rights issues, are really a direct continuation of 1400 years of abuse and domination. And I sometimes feel it's quite sad when I hear Muslims who, as I said, have a kind of idealized theological conception of the perfection of Islam and impose that on the evidence and are willing to rely on cherry-picked sources to present that view and then overlook even the evidence of their own sources, even the evidence of Muslim authoritative Muslim sources, which describe a very different reality.
I would say, Mark, it's an interesting claim. Would you like to quote some sources and tell us where we find statements telling us that we must treat the non-Muslims and Dhimmis in a way which is not fair, which is not just, or anything like that? I mean, you have made a lot of claims. You have made a lot of interesting claims, but you haven't put out any substance, and you have written a book, so you should be able to bring out something.
Let's allow Mark to do that then.
Well, I quote from almost 30 tafsir commentaries in my explanation of Surah 929, which is the key verse in the Quran referring to the state. I quote, for example, from Ibn Kathir's commentary, which he says that non-Muslims should be belittled and disgraced and humiliated. I quote from Ibn Rushdi Averroes, who said the Muslim jurists agree that the purpose of fighting the people of the book is either for their conversion to Islam or their payment of the jizya. I go into quite considerable detail explaining.
You also bring up a number of instances of sort of historical accounts of these actual payments, these annual sort of payments, and you describe these sort of very worrying practices whereby it was all very symbolically done, whereby the Dhimmi would enter into the presence of the Muslim authority. They would come in on their knees. They would sort of be slapped. There were various aspects to this the foot would be placed on the neck when they actually delivered the tax over. And for you, this is all actually about not just the tax; it's about the actual way that the Dhimmis were being made to feel the if you like, the psychological effect of the Dhimmitude.
Oh, that's right. Al-Baydawi said that when they pay the tax, they will be struck, and they have to undergo they're struck on the even Abbas. So he said that the Dhimmi must be struck on the neck as they pay. I think it's a symbolic blow on the head to show that they're escaping with their head intact through the ritual. Other jurists or writers of commentaries, Al-Alusi said the jizya is a payment as a reward for being given a pardon for death. Muhammad ibn Yusuf At-Fayish, in his commentary, said that the jizya is a satisfaction for their blood. It's a payment to substitute for the duties, the wajib of killing and slavery for the benefit of Muslims. Well, there are many Muslim commentaries that explain the meaning of the jizya and of the tax. Al-Zamakhshari explains about the ritual of the payment of the tax. And it's this is a very copiously documented. It's just that these things are not usually brought into the light of day.
Well, obviously that's what that your book is aiming to do. But Adnan, I'm sure you want to respond. I mean, this sounds terrible. These kinds of rituals that were associated with the Dimitri.
I'm very confident that Mark will not be able to pull anything out to support these statements made by these later jurists from the Prophet. If Mark can pull out something from the Quran or from a prophetic tradition, I will accept. I will submit. I can very humbly challenge Mark to bring something out from the Prophet where the Prophet said to strike the non-Muslims in this way, humiliate them in this way, or mistreat them in this way. In fact, what the Prophet said in Sahih al-Bukhari, in the book of Jihad, which is the most authentic book after the Quran, the Prophet stated that if anyone who kills a dhimmi, a mu'ahid, someone we have a contract with, such a person will never smell the fragrance of paradise. Okay?
Yeah, I cite that
yes.
in my book.
Yes.
I did cite that in my book and explain that the
sure.
If you
let me finish, Mark, very quickly. Umar bin Khattab, in the same chapter in the Book of Jihad, the second caliph of Islam, on his deathbed, he stated that whoever succeeds me as caliph must not put a burden upon the non-Muslims more than they can bear, must fight for them if he has to protect them, and preserve their rights and fulfill promises with them. So these statements, which come from the Prophet and his closest companions, are what we follow. This is what Sharia is. Sharia, when we use the word Sharia in a loose sense, we must define what Sharia is in the first place. Sharia comes from the Quran and from the prophetic tradition. What Alusi, or what Zamakhshari, what Baydawi, what Ibn Kathir, Ibn Taymiyyah, and these later jurists were saying, reflecting the thought and the conditioning of their own time, is not what we follow. For example, most of these scholars Mark has mentioned were living very close to the time of the Crusades, okay? And there was a very, very deep hatred to be found among the Muslims for the Christians, and vice versa, because of the wars.
I'd be interested in getting your response to that, Mark. I mean, is this kind of isolated cases that don't reflect the actual scriptures of Islam, or do you feel that the way it was implemented does in some sense reflect the spirit of what is taught in the Quran and the Hadiths?
I think there is a kernel of truth here. That is the elaboration of all the laws of the Bima, and even of the ritual of the payment of the tax did take place over some centuries. So there were many, many, many laws and restrictions added over time. However, that's the reality of what Islam has been and is. The humiliating jizya payment ritual continued for the Jews in Afghanistan right up until the 1950s. So you might say, well, some of those details are in medieval commentaries. But yes, those commentaries determined how states and rulers practiced their religion, and there are lots of observers like that shipwreck captain Riley in Morocco who describes these rituals being applied. So that's one point. Secondly, Ibn Abbas is the authority, who's the companion of Muhammad, as the source for this next striking, is cited in the commentaries. Thirdly, the commentators in explaining these principles of humiliation, they're really meant to humiliate the non-Muslims, do it on the basis of Surah 929, which speaks about the Muslims as non-Muslims as paying the tax and also being made small. So this is interpreted as what being tiny or low or small means. And it's very much a pious attempt to apply the Quran's teaching that the people of the book, when they are conquered,
before we go to a response from Adnan, I mean, you kind of not only draw out the historical nature of these things, but you make allusions to the fact that the way Muslims want to be treated today has its roots in this issue of dhimmitude. So you talk about the fact that the way that Muslim Islamic response to criticism and the feeling that that, if you like, not being open to criticism of any kind the way that we see responses to that all stems from this issue of the subjugation of other belief systems to Islam. So although obviously we don't see these rituals being enacted today, what you're saying is that the impact continues in the mindset of Islam today. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that is a problem. The Quran does teach Muslims that Islam, Muslims are superior, and I think many Muslims do have a sense of their superiority and can feel deeply offended if they feel belittled or humiliated, they will often say, by things that happen. And so this concept of honour and humiliation and superiority, inferiority, this way of looking at the world, which has shaped the position of non-Muslims under Islam, is a big challenge for Muslims living on an equal basis with other people. Because if you're really concerned about status, inferiority, superiority, I think it damages the way you see yourself. And I think that what we're seeing often is that there's almost a demand that Islam be respected, a demand that Muslims be treated as somehow a special case and superior in a sense. And that's not very helpful. It's not good for Muslims.
Let me ask what Adnan makes of that. I mean, I think a lot of people will hear what Mark's saying there and think, yeah, that's the way Muslims do seem to act, you know, as though we need to be given special privileges and never to be questioned, never to sort of, you know, some people do have that view of Islam as being very concerned with its honour. And if you ever do anything to disrespect, then it, as we were saying last week, you know, the way Muslims often on the ground react to things like the Danish cartoons, the Pope's comments, it's violence, it's, you know, it's extreme. Is any of that kind of, as Mark would suggest, coming from this kind of history of the issue of honor and subjugation in Islam?
Well, in my humble opinion, Christianity has the history of suppressing the freedom to express oneself or freedom of conscience. For example, we have the example of Inquisition, Crusades, all these things were taking place. And now Mark, as a Christian, would say, no, this was against the teachings of Christ. We follow Christ, we follow the tradition, we follow the early apostles. We don't listen to these things, we don't pay any attention to them, even though we can find a few Christian authors here and there in the Middle Ages condemning such practices, such as Crusades, Inquisition, and burning of witches. So if I was to draw a similar analogy or a similar comparison between what the Christians do today and what they seek to do today and what they did in the Middle Ages, it would be very unfair. I mean, I wouldn't do that because we are living in different realities.
And you feel Mark shouldn't attempt to do that either?
No, because to be consistent, if Mark is telling us that this is to be found in medieval literature, if Mark was to go back and study, for example, Imam Nawawi, when he was commenting on these rituals such as slapping and discriminating against the Jews and the Christians, he condemned such practices. He said these practices are not proven from the Sunnah of the Prophet. This was not the way of the Prophet. This is not the way of the Quran. We shouldn't be indulging in these practices. We should discourage them. So there was a debate between Muslim theologians and jurists as to what we should be doing with the Christians when we receive jizya. And most jurists agreed that jizya must be taken, and it must be taken in the way the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam taught us to take it. So what the medieval authors are writing and expressing their views, obviously reflecting the conditions of their time, such as Crusades and other hostile experiences they had with the Christians of their time, is not reflected in the early teaching of Islam.
What then is the cause of the reaction that many Muslims have when they hear their religion in any way criticized or in any way insulted, which to so many people seems so unnecessarily aggressive and violent?
Okay, this would be understood if the scholars or commentators or authors like Mark Thierry were to sit down and study the concept of love for the Prophet in Islam. We love our Prophet. Not that the Christians don't love their prophets. Of course they do. We love our Prophet in a different way. We love our Prophet too much.
To a fault, almost.
I wouldn't say to a fault, but we are. It's one of the tenets of Islam to love your Prophet
and to love him more, and accord him honor.
Exactly, to love him more than your parents. So if, for example, any human being, any standard person walking on the street with his girlfriend or with his wife, if his wife or girlfriend was insulted in front of him, he would definitely stand up to defend her. We deem the Prophet much higher in respect than our wives, our mothers, our fathers, our grandparents, all of them. So we have to respect and protect his honor. And the way we do it is to follow the laws of Islam.
But that presumably doesn't justify the way that some people
respond. No, of course not. The mob. Islam doesn't have a mob culture. Islam doesn't promote mob culture. We don't believe in mob violence.
But it perhaps explains where the mentality comes from, even if it's sometimes expressed wrongly.
If we were to do a comparison between Muslims and Christians of Nigeria, for example, Muslims were burning the effigies of George Bush and Tony Blair or some of the cartoonists, and if we were to go to Nigeria and look at some of the Christians behaving in a similar manner, we can't blame Christianity for that, what they're doing. We have to blame the ignorance they are suffering from.
We just got a couple of minutes for you to respond, Mark, and then we'll enter the final part of our program. What do you make of that analysis that Adnan's given for where these sorts of issues arise as far as the Muslim view of the Prophet and the love they have for him?
I think you can love someone enormously, but it doesn't mean you're prepared to strike or kill someone for speaking ill of them. That's a different issue. It's not just love. It's another factor. And I think the real motivation or the real reason has to do with the early origins of Islam, and Muhammad himself did condone those who used violence to stand up for his reputation. There's a hadith of a man who killed his slave wife because she was insulting or speaking ill of Muhammad, and Muhammad approved of this. And there are other examples as well. Muhammad was pretty uncompromising about people that made funny songs about him. And so I think the actual, and this is reflected, as Adnan said, or sort of indicated in Sharia law, that it's very, very extreme penalties for those that mock Muhammad or mock Islam. And that's very much based on the foundations of Islam. I don't think it's driven by love. It's driven by something else, a deeper thing. The other thing I want to say is that very much about my book, the principles that are laid out there don't derive just from the period of the Crusades. They go back to the 9th and even the 8th century. In Egypt today, as I explained, it's very difficult to build a church or repair a church. Very extreme restrictions on building and repairing places of worship. That goes back to the Pact of Umar, to the conquest of Palestine, to the early covenants of surrender of the non-Muslims. It's back to the very earliest period of Islam, and it's part of the root. And that's a serious problem, and that's also explains why the issue has been so enduring, why Muslims, pious Muslims around the world are not rising up and telling the Egyptian government they should let Christians build churches and repair churches. They're not saying the example of Muhammad demands that you should give the Christians these rights. They're actually not doing that, and the reason is that there isn't that basis in the foundations of Islam.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and then I will let Adnan respond. I can see you're ready to respond to what Mark has said there. But you're listening to an edition of Unbelievable, looking at the issue of Islam, Dimitude and Freedom. That's the subtitle of Mark Jury's book, The Third Choice. Mark has been making the case on the programme today that the doctrine of dimitude, the way that non-Muslims are treated under Islamic law, is an oppressive and discriminatory code that endures in many ways today. Adnan Rashid of the Hitton Institute has been contending that this is a very one-sided way of a biased view of what dimitude comprised. It was essentially peace treaties that ensured safety and peace within those borders. I encourage you to get the book if you want to look at that. I'll also be posting up links to other resources that Adnan will recommend with the podcast of this programme. So premier.org.uk/unbelievable. If you want to listen back to the programme and click through to some of the links to books and other resources that are there. Back in just a moment's time as we conclude today's programme. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. Hope you're ready for Christmas, and if you are or if you're not, you'll want to tune in anyway on Christmas Day to Unbelievable. We've got a special show for you. It's the Unbelievable Christmas Cracker. I'm going to be joined by a variety of guests. Anthony McCroy will be my studio guest, and we'll be linking up with international guests, defenders of the Christian faith around the world, to talk about various aspects of Christmas, including what about people who claim it's just a pagan festival? What about those who say that there are other accounts of the Christmas story in other extra-biblical gospels? And we'll be having a bit of a fun look at things like Father Christmas. Are there any Christian roots to him? And Christmas trees, do they descend from pagan traditions? Well, my guest Anthony McCroy says no, and he's going to be offering evidence to suggest that both Father Christmas and Christmas trees are in fact have Christian roots. So it should be a fascinating programme next week, quite light-hearted as well. We're not being quite so adversarial as we normally are on this programme. So do join me for that, the Unbelievable Christmas Cracker, between 2:30 and 4 o'clock here on Premier Christian Radio, and of course online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Don't forget your feedback coming up towards the end of today's programme. In the meantime, let's return to today's topic.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And we're concluding today's programme on Islam and the kind of religious freedoms that it allowed historically under its rule for those where Islam had become the dominant religion, had conquered other peoples and tribes and religions. Was there a just, if you like, system in place? Was there a golden age of Islam when peace reigned and there was, if you like, a mutual harmony and respect? Well, Mark Dury, the Australian pastor who has published the book The Third Choice, claims that is a little bit of an overstatement at the least. Adnan Rashid says actually no, there has been a golden age and there can be again. Dimitude is not what Mark describes it as. Adnan, you wanted to respond, I think, to the way Mark was characterising the fact he was saying in that last section that actually these practices were not just responding to the issues of the Crusades, etc. You can see them having gone quite far back in even to Muhammad himself and the way he treated people who...
Yes.
Who mocked him?
Mocking is another issue altogether. That's the topic we discussed last week, and this is another topic in itself, that whether Islam allows freedom to insult any of the messengers of God, for example, Jesus, Moses, or Muhammad. Islam doesn't allow that freedom. It is the law of Islam, and that's how it stands. Coming to the issue of Prophet Muhammad accepting the execution of someone who insulted him. I mean, even if you go to the Bible, Jesus Christ, he gives a parable of a king, and the king states that those who would not have me reign over them, I would bring them hither and kill them, okay? And Mark would say it was a parable, but the question is, why would Jesus put that parable forward in the first place? What is he trying to tell his companions? So it's a parable with a message in it. So Jesus was not a pacifist, as some Christians would like to put it. Coming back to the issue of dimitude, for example, what Mark is saying, again, I really, really have strong reservations against some of the views put by Mark, because modern scholarship, if we study some of it, we come to realize that they have other conclusions to draw from some of the early history of Islam. For example, Professor Dean Philip Bell, in his book Jews in Early Modern Europe, states that Jews had their golden age under the rule of Islam from the year 900 to 1300. This is what Dean Philip Bell said in his book. Then we have Reinhard Dozy, one of the authorities on the history of Islamic Spain. He states that the Christians preferred the Islamic rule over the Christian rule in Spain.
Mark, do you accept that there are instances in which Christians and others were happy under their Islamic, if you like, leaders?
I think the conditions did vary over long, large expanses of time and space, and sometimes they were better than others, and there were times when one religious group may have been better under Muslims than under non-Muslims, or felt better off. There's a diversity of testimony about that. I think there is a weakness in some Western scholarship, this desire to kind of praise this golden age idea. I think that's really a mistake, as it's a sort of a view of history that's very static, that there's these unrelenting centuries of enjoyment of peaceful and
what would make people want to present it that way, though? Why would they present it?
There's various reasons. It began in the 19th century. There was a political pressure to support the European support for the Ottoman Empire in their battle against the Russians. There was also secularists or sometimes Jewish writers wanting to kind of hit Christians over the head and use Islam as a kind of way of shaming Christians in the 19th century. It's very complex. I discuss it in my book, but let me give you an example, just to give you that there's a diversity of voices on this issue. Maimonides, one of the greatest Jewish writers from the Middle Ages, who'd grown up in Andalusia in Spain and had to flee persecution there to Egypt. He wrote this letter to the Jews of Yemen, who persecute us severely and devise ways to harm us and to debase us. No nation has ever done more harm to Israel. None has matched it in debasing and humiliating us. None has been able to reduce us as they have. The more we suffer and choose to conciliate them, the more they choose to act belligerently towards us. Now, this is the voice of a very famous Jewish writer from the medieval period, in the middle of those centuries that were described as excellent. And the problem is to be so selective in choosing, you know, one voice and not another, not to pay attention to the contrary evidence, that there was a lot of suffering and poverty and forced conversions and people unable to pay their taxes.
I appreciate that Adnan probably is going to want to respond. I mean, one thing I do want to draw out here, though, is that you make a point towards the end of the book, Mark, about whether the Christian response is helpful. I mean, in a sense, Jesus said, if your enemy strikes you on one cheek, offer them the other. Christianity is premised on this kind of non-retaliatory sort of premise, if you like. But you say that this could be interpreted as simply playing into the hands of those who want to establish dhimmitude again, that this could be seen as a submissive state and Islam taking its rightful place, if you like, if the Christian response were carried out in that way. It's kind of a bit of a dilemma, isn't it? Because
there's an asymmetry of understanding, potentially. So someone might be generous, thinking they're being gracious, you know, making concessions, going out of your way to be peaceful and to conciliate. But the other side might receive all this as their due, as a debt owed. So, if a European country gives money to Egypt, or America gives money to Egypt, is that aid or is it tribute? You know, how do you look at these exchanges? And I think that's a big problem for Christians in the West sometimes in engaging with Islam. They feel they're really trying hard to be gracious, but is this grace received as grace or is it received as a debt owed, as evidence of the superiority?
I have to confess, in my dealings with, for instance, down at Hyde Park, you know, when I've been there at the debates that have taken place between Christians and Muslims, some of the Christians who come from Middle Eastern countries and from places where Islam is dominant actually are frustrated by Western Christians' attitude towards Islam, and they say we need a more muscular Christianity. I mean, we might be coming slightly off topic here, Adnan, but
yeah, that's true. I mean, the example was in the UK where Muslim police said we don't want to wear the crown on our helmets because it's got a tiny cross on it, and the British authorities agreed to that. I mean, I think it's a terrible mistake to take the sign of sovereignty off the helmets of the police to allow that. Oh yes, this would have, must be very distressing to Muslims to have that on their helmets, so we'll take the British crown off, you know. That's a really bad mistake, and it, it's I think it comes across as a sign of weakness, really,
and of submission. But do you agree? I mean, are these concessions kind of taken by Muslims as kind of somehow their due?
Muslims have never been a majority in this country, and they would never take it as a weakness. Rather, they would take it, if it happened, they would take it as a gesture of kindness from the government and a gesture of tolerance on government's behalf, and which is beautiful. I don't think it's a mistake. If the government did it, it's a kind thing to do. It's the right thing to do. It's a thing which would enable the Muslims to think that they are valued and they are welcome in this country. Unfortunately, some of the Christian preachers do come with a message of love and compassion and tolerance. On the other hand, we have some of the Christians campaigning actively in this country against the building of a mosque, and they are Christians. So we feel, as Muslims, we feel threatened. We feel, what if the Christians came to power? Or these evangelical Christians, if they came to power, would they allow us to live in peace? Would they allow us to have our mosques? Coming back to my main issue of dimitude, Mark quoted Maimonides from the Middle Ages, and he quoted one of his letters. What Mark failed to acknowledge was that Maimonides was a product of an Islamic society. Maimonides was born in Islamic Spain, expelled by the Almohads, who were very harsh in the treatment of the non-Muslims, which is an established fact in history. But on the other hand, Maimonides was protected by Saladin and his judge. Maimonides was due to be executed as an apostate, because under persecution he embraced Islam. But when he came to Egypt, he went back to Judaism and he was accused of apostasy. But it was one of the judges of Saladin who came to his rescue and rescued him from that persecution. And he stated that this man is not an apostate because he was never a Muslim. What I see in the book possibly is what Mark is doing, is that he's cherry picking. I would ask the listeners to go and read another book on the other to see the other side of the picture, which is titled Preaching of Islam by Thomas Arnold, published in the year 1913, and a fascinating book documenting all the tolerant and beautiful and good things Muslims did to the non-Muslims. Preaching of Islam, Thomas Arnold, 1913.
All right, we'll thank you for the reference, and if we can dig out a copy of that, it would be interesting to see. Mark, we come to the end of our time now. What do you hope will be achieved by you writing this book? I mean, you're not writing this presumably to upset anyone. You stated at the outset you want to kind of make an objective case for what the situation is.
Yeah, I think people in the UK or any country should reach out with grace and friendship to Muslims and get to know them and realise they're people like themselves and understand what makes them tick and engage with them and love them. We would say to Christians, love Muslims, understand them. But I think that we should make very few, if any, concessions at all to political Islam, to Sharia implementation. There's a survey a few years back in the UK said that 40% of Muslims in the UK support the Sharia law in some form for the UK. But you see, this discrimination, the treatment of one type of people as a protected people whose rights are given to them by the Muslims and are dependent upon them for their rights, and the privileging of one religious group over another, this is part of Sharia, and it is already kind of creeping its way into our society with restrictions on freedom of speech, asymmetrical limitations on people's rights, and this needs to be guarded against. I don't think it's helpful. I think ultimately it will undermine peace. It's important to understand what the long-term implications of introducing Sharia law are in the society, and I think we should be friends with Muslims, reach out to them, but make absolutely no compromises where it comes to Sharia implementation in Western societies.
Well, thank you for contributing to the program today, and we'll let you get on to your bed because it's quite late already in your part of Australia. Thank you for joining me today, Mark. And if you want to find out more about Mark, I'm posting up links to where you can find out about him with the podcast of this program. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can find details of the book there that we've been looking at as well. Adnan, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
It's been great to have you on for the last 2 weeks of the programme, and thank you for engaging with Mark today. Obviously, you disagreed with almost everything he said, but that I was sort of expecting that. And I'll post up a link to where people can find out more about you as well. So thank you for listening today. If you have been writing in by email or phoning in with a voicemail message, you may be hearing it in just a moment's time. We're going to hear some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming here on the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, you may remember that Adnan also joined me last week on the programme, and we've got some of your responses to that. He was interacting with representatives from Christian Solidarity Worldwide, Stuart Windsor and John Joseph, on Islamic blasphemy law, particularly in relation to the case of Asia Bibi, the Christian woman who has been sentenced to death for allegedly profaning or blaspheming the Prophet Muhammad in Pakistan. Well, we've got plenty of your reaction to the whole issue of whether Islam should have a death penalty for blasphemy. Roger Morris over at Faith Interface in Australia emailed in to say the discussion is obviously of great relevance in the UK, where British expats and other international observers have seen the cultural changes in Britain over the last few decades. I would say, though, that Britain may serve as a good example of how not to do multiculturalism and religious pluralism without losing the original cultural flavour of the country in the process. In many ways, the willingness of Muslims to react to perceived slurs against Muhammad and Allah is commendable compared to the pathetic hand-wringing of most Christians in secular nations when Christ is insulted or slurred. In my mind, there is a gross misapplication of Matthew 5:39, where, and you quote here, "But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn them the other cheek also." Matthew there is not an excuse for snivelling weakness and insipid platitudes in the face of gratuitous slurs and insults against Christ. I suggest that we as Christians, in our pursuit of religious tolerance and respect for all religious belief, including our own, in secular countries, should respond more assertively ourselves to blasphemy, insults and slurs against Christ, which is a clear form of religious vilification and disrespect of our Christian beliefs and convictions. Of course, I'm not advocating the excessive violence and threats of violence displayed by Islamic extremists. Rather, I'm advocating Christians using the full force of religious vilification laws in their country against persons and organisations that gratuitously insult Christ our Lord and Saviour. It seems only fair and equal to me, says Roger. Thank you, Roger. Roger, by the way, will be one of my international guests phoning into the show on our Christmas cracker next week. Let's hear some of your voicemails now in response to the issue of Islamic blasphemy law, which we were discussing last week on the programme.
Hello, it's Sue in Chester, and the only thing I can say is I don't know whose gods they serve, but I don't need to fight for my God. I need my God to fight for me, and that's how it works. Thank you, and goodbye.
Hello, my name is Freddy. The gentleman who is representing the Muslims, he lives here in UK in a free society. I happen to come from Africa, where just mentioning the name of Jesus in Muslim countries, but coming to kill somebody in the name of blasphemy, I don't agree with it, because it depends on how they define it.
Hey, it's Poppy speaking. Like Justin said something about why don't our Muslims react really badly when something's like said about their business and whatnot, basically. And I think it's just because they're like passionate about what they believe in, and they're like really dedicated in that. And I think Christians should have the same passion and like the same dedication as them. I think they should learn from that. I agree with you, it's not right, and they get it wrong, but like I think I admire their passion for like what they believe. They're like sold out on it. So,
well, an interesting mixture of views there. Poppy, in many ways, agreeing with Roger Morris's view that we heard before those voicemails, that Christians need to stand up more for themselves in the way that Muslims do, though perhaps not to the extent that some Muslims do. But kind of in contrast to the first caller there, who said that as far as she's concerned, God fights on our behalf. We don't need to fight on God's behalf. Thanks to all those who've been getting in touch that way. Going back to a few episodes back, and I should mention, if you want to email in, or indeed to phone in, here's the way to do it on today's topic. 08456 52 52 52, select option 8, and that'll get you to the Unbelievable voicemail. If you want to email me, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And lots of discussions as well, if you want to join in, as it were, a live discussion, go on at the Premier Community, the Unbelievable page there, accessible via the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. So a number of you still emailing me in response to the Gorilla Christian show, very popular show that was, where David Robertson came on and answered questions from three skeptics. David Robertson himself is a Christian pastor and has written books defending Christianity against atheism. Philip Raymond in Australia wanted to say, David was quite correct to say the Bible has metaphor, parables, poetry and history, and that we should consider the genre and intent of the Bible passages. However, he is incorrect to dismiss the creation account as something other than history. Later Bible writers and Jesus himself spoke of the events from the early chapters of Genesis as though they literally happened. And that was David, of course, responding to the first caller on whether I have to believe everything literally in the Bible happened. Obviously, you disagree with David's take on the book of Genesis, well, certainly the very early chapters of Genesis. Michael in Mansfield says, as someone with an interest in Christian apologetics, I frequently listen to your podcast with mixed interest. While I was listening to your last Gorilla Christian with David Robertson, I was reminded about some material in the book Beyond the Cosmos by Hugh Ross that I'd just been reading. I was struck that the theme of extra dimensionality in the book would have been beneficial in answering the questions posed in the broadcast, and in particular the last one on petitionary prayer and free will. I rather like the work of Reasons to Believe, and so may I suggest that you research the book and possibly, if you feel it would be benefit, invite Hugh onto your programme. Of course, we have had Hugh on talking about the universe in response to Stephen Hawking, but I wasn't aware of this particular philosophical dimension of it. The subject of prayer and how on earth it makes sense in regard to a God who knows everything already was raised by one of those skeptics a couple of weeks ago, and it's probably the topic that's generated the most feedback. Here's also Nicole writing in on this. I'm just going to read a few sentences, really. Your email was quite long, Nicole. I'll just try and pick out a few that struck me. You say, I believe that prayer is the means by which God teaches us many things, including, not necessarily solely, that God is able to give. Prayer in this way is the instrument where God personally teaches us about him, about us, and about the relationship between him and us. Later you say, whilst God, being omniscient, does not require our prayers to change things, we're still to pray that God will move in the situation. The things that are being changed are not necessarily things we ask for, example, to remove the cancer of a loved one, but often include changes in our own character or heart that will transform us for the better. For it is the condition of our hearts he is most concerned about with regards to us. And again later you say, an omniscient and omnipotent God does not need our prayers to move things, but he has so ordained this as a way to move heaven so that we can participate in God's plans as partners. Such is grace, when absolute knowledge, power and presence are in perfect balance and unity, when we become his children through Jesus Christ, therefore becoming royal co-heirs with him. As such, rather than a futile venture, it is an amazing and humbling realization that a sovereign God, omnipotent and omniscient, would design an instrument of prayer so that we may enjoy his fellowship and participate in his plans of eternal bearing. Futility is found in petitions to God when our prayer leaves no room for God to be God. If we truly accept him not only as God, but one who has our best interest at heart, we would allow him to respond as a God who cannot fail to meet our needs. Thank you very much for that email as well. Thanks for all who've been getting in touch with me about that. A few people wanted to comment on older shows. John Humphrey over in the States says, wanted to drop you a line, let you know I'm a listener here, and I wanted to say I've just finished listening to the May 15th edition of the programme, Peter Hitchens on the Rage Against God. I've just listened to it through the fourth time and I absolutely love it so much that I went out and brought his book and recently got through reading that. Thank you so much for providing past shows in a downloadable format. Thank you very much for listening, John, out in the States. Here's Linda in Toronto, Canada, says, really enjoying the show. You wanted to talk about the ex-gay Christian show. We had Jonathan Berry from the True Freedom Trust believe it, as a gay Christian, says he leads a celibate lifestyle because he doesn't believe the Bible condones homosexual behaviour. And he was in conversation with Jeremy, who was a man who runs Courage, and he is also a gay Christian, but believes that there is scope for Christians in a same-sex committed relationship. So you say, I'm not convinced that homosexuality is what God intended for us. My opinion is the same as Jonathan Berry. However, I know you like to present different opinions, and I was thinking you may want to consider having Dr. Patrick Chapman on your show to hear what he has to say. Among many things, he is a professor and an author. He's a gay man, extremely educated, and the details of his book titled Thou Shalt Not Love are pasted in for your review. Thank you very much, Linda. Quinton wanted to comment on that episode as well. He says, I love the programme. I haven't come across anything like it. It's the way Christians should always communicate, being open to reasonable discussion without feeling threatened or losing their cool. I have a question on the ex-gay and gay-affirming approaches to homosexuality. One of the interviewees had come to the conclusion, and this was Jeremy, that a loving, monogamous gay relationship would be acceptable to God. And he gave an account of the Bible verses he felt affirmed this. I'd really like to know how realistic this point of view is. I've heard that it's more the case that long-term monogamous gay relationships are statistically meaningless because promiscuity is virtually the only experience in the gay community. If this were true, wouldn't it cast doubt on legitimating the lifestyle as something long-term, loving and monogamous? Thank you, Quinton, for those interactions. I think that Jeremy would say that he's in no way endorsing that type of gay lifestyle. And I guess he would say, even if it's not the majority experience, but I have no statistics whatsoever to say whether it is or isn't. He would say that that is the only form of homosexual relationship he would endorse, a committed, loving same-sex relationship. But anyway, interesting views still coming in on that program. So if you want to get in touch on that one, this one, or anyone, you can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Thanks for being with me on the programme today. More of your emails next week. But it's a very special edition of the programme next week. Let me tell you why. You're unbelievable. Yes, it's Christmas next week, Christmas Day. First time Unbelievable will have broadcast on Christmas Day on Premier Christian Radio. So we're doing it a little bit differently. It's going to be a slightly lighter show. We're going to have guests from around the world joining me. You're going to hear people from Australia, Canada, USA. And I'm going to have in the studio with me Anthony McRoy, who's a Bible scholar from Wales. And we're going to be hearing why he believes that the claims of some Christians, that there are pagan, if you like, roots to various aspects of Christmas are simply unfounded. Find out why on the show next week. Some really other really interesting conversations going on that show. Do hope you can join me. Same time, same place, but it's Christmas Day next week here on the show that gets you thinking. Unbelievable.